Raymond M. Binkowski is not a physician or registered dietitian. The contents of this should not be taken as medical advice. It's not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any health problem, nor is it intended to replace the advice of a physician. Always consult your physician or qualified health professional on any matters regarding your health. If you're interested in learning more about the content in this podcast, webinar, or episode, click the link in the description or comments to learn more.
All right, Ray. So we're talking contest prep today, which I have a brief history in, but there's still going to be things that I'm sure I get to learn. And it's been a while since I've been in this world. So this will be a good refresher for me too. So I thought it would be great if you just start off by give everyone a brief synopsis of what the bodybuilding world is today, how you can compete. I want you to break down the different categories, what that looks like. Does everyone look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, or are there different categories? Kind of give us a modern look at what's available today.
So bodybuilding would be physique contest, and there today it's no longer just bodybuilding, and categories are split typically by gender. And on the women's side, we would have women's bikini, women's figure, women's physique, women's wellness. And then on the men's side, we would have men's bodybuilding, men's physique, and men's classic physique. The next piece, and I'll explain a little bit about what each of those categories are. The next piece is drug-free or not drug-free. And the overwhelming majority of images, what people will think of, like when you said bodybuilding, like what most people listening are watching this, what comes to mind is probably from the drug side of the sport. And it's kind of a dirty little secret, but on the majority of what people think of when we say bodybuilding, all those images are of people on drugs. And that side of the sport doesn't, they don't publicize that. Obviously, they don't say, hey, all the athletes that do this are on drugs. It's just something that they kind of gloss over. It just doesn't come up. On the drug-free side of the sport, which there is, like I have been in OCB, which is an organization promoter since 2005. And to date, I've promoted between 35 and 40 contests. And we 100% drug test every athlete that competes in our events. So there's going to be the drug side of the sport, which we won't talk much about today, and the drug tested, drug free side of the sport. Now I say drug tested, drug free, because there are events promoted by organizations that are marketed as natural or drug free, but they are not 100% drug tested. So individuals that are interested in getting into this, I always say you need to, whatever event you're going to do, you need to understand what the rules and guidelines are and make sure it's a good fit for you. And then know what you're signing up for, know what you're getting into. You know, the onus is on the athlete to know what the rules and guidelines, regulations, things that might not be allowed. For example, like our organization does not allow prescription testosterone, so hormone replacement therapy. Even if it's by a doctor, it's not allowed. So you need to know what those rules are going into it. And then when we look at categories on the women's side of the sport, women's bikini is going to be looks good in a bikini, but has muscle definition. And you can see that they have actual muscle. It's not a Hawaiian Tropics bathing suit contest. Women's figure is going to be more muscle mass, leaner, and then kind of an hourglass or an X frame. Women's physique, even more muscle mass, much leaner, in a much more exaggerated hourglass or an X frame. And then women's wellness is going to be athletes that are very lower body muscle dominant. So they're asymmetrical. So lean, muscular, but asymmetrical top to bottom. So maybe that athlete was a collegiate soccer player, or maybe they were a short distance sprinter and did high school and collegiate track. So the muscle mass of their lower body is much greater than that of the upper. And when we talk about the categories, it's best to consider a blacked out silhouette. So the blacked out silhouette of bikini is almost a straight up and down physique. a blacked out silhouette of figure is going to be that hourglass X frame. A blacked out silhouette women's physique is going to be a much larger X frame. And what I mean by that is a much larger drop from upper back shoulder width to waist, and then much larger increase to at the thighs. So much more muscle mass. And then wellness, I always explain wellness, it's kind of like a stick on an inverted V. So asymmetrical top to bottom, much larger lower body. Now with wellness, we're not talking fat. It's not a female athlete that just carries a significant amount of body fat in their glutes, hamstrings, and quads. On the men's side, bodybuilding is going to be the leanest of the three categories, maximum muscle mass, a big V taper, kind of that X frame again. The men's physique is going to wear a board short, so there it's a larger bathing suit, not nearly as large as bodybuilding, not as lean. And then classic physique is kind of a bathing suit that would resemble like a men's brief in terms of underwear, not as small of a bathing suit as bodybuilding, yet smaller than the board short. Almost as lean as bodybuilding, not quite as large as bodybuilding, bigger and leaner than men's physique. And it's going to include the classic, some of the classic poses in kind of a throwback to the like 1960s and early 1970s before athletes really started to take significant amounts of performance enhancing drugs and end up almost cartoon character, superhuman looking. So those would be the categories.
So do you help people choose a category? If they come to you and say, I just want to compete, what's the most advantageous? Do you help guide them based on their current body, or how does that work?
Absolutely. So kind of like all things in life, it's better to play to your strengths and become great at things you're already good at than strive to be almost average at things you're not good at. So we would look at the individuals, again, we black out their silhouette and say, which one of these pictures do you look like? Do you have, like, if you're a female, do you have an X frame? Okay, you do. Well, how big are you? Like, how wide are your shoulders? How tiny does your waist look? And then it would be a conversation of, would the right fit be figure, or would the right fit be women's physique? If the individual, if it's that, you know, typical athlete that has a history of short distance sprinting and track, where they've got really developed glutes, really developed quads and hamstrings, they're not fat in their lower body. It's just they have much more muscle mass from the waist down than they do the waist up. They still got muscle mass in the upper body. It's just asymmetrical. We're probably going to start leaning toward that women's wellness. But yes, it's a conversation we absolutely have. And it usually, you know, revolves around what's the genetic predisposition, and then let's play to those strains.
Mm-hmm. So give me an example of some of the current clients that you do work with, like what ages, give me some broad factors so that people can see the range that you do work with and that you don't have to have a history of competing to work with you and things like that.
So currently, and this has held true probably the last 5 or maybe 6 years of working with clients that have an interest in competing, the average age is probably close to 40. From a gender standpoint, 60 to 65% of my clients are female. So middle-aged female. Statistically significant number of them are coaches and trainers themselves. So they have a background in fitness. They have a background in coaching. They have a background in training. And some of them are first-time competitors, and some of them are pro competitors. So they've been competing for some time, including at the professional level.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into programming next. And I know that this could be an entire episode in and of itself, but give me a framework of when should someone, let's go from a viewpoint of the person that is moderately active, somewhat lean, you know, a type of person that maybe people think should compete. How long do they need to program for? What does that look like? When do they start? Do you want them to be to a certain point before they start working with you?
Yeah, so great, all great questions. From experience, and we saw this in our commercial gym. So I owned a large commercial gym and training center for a long time. We saw that one-on-one personal training clients over 3 months made great progress and often started to build a habit. But what we also saw was clients that continued didn't just do personal training for 3 months. Those that did 5 or 6 months, not only did they continue to make great progress, but they started to cement that habit in a lifestyle. Over the last, I don't know how many years, asking competitors at the two contests I promote every year that have placed top three, top five, how long did you spend getting ready? The average amount of time is about 20 weeks. So once again, that 5 months, just like we saw in our commercial gym, that 5 months comes up. So for most people, it's going to be a 5 month, 20 week timetable to get ready. Now, even before that, people, when they start looking for an event or a contest, especially if you're brand new, I encourage them to look at the calendar, look at a contest schedule, and find a contest that is within a car ride of where they live. And the reason I say that is, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend money to fly by air, to get on an airplane and fly somewhere to compete, and then incur all of the other expenses that come with that. But more importantly, all of the stress that comes with travel on top of getting on stage. Now, if you're a seasoned veteran competitor, chasing a pro card, or you are competing at the pro level, separate conversation. So I recommend people find something that's 2 or 3 hours away by car and that they start there. Okay, what's the date of that? And then back out at least 5 months. And that's going to be a rough average for many that would allow them to get ready. Now, if you're listening to this and you're 47 years old and you've never lifted weights, and you're overweight, there's a good chance it's going to take longer. If you're 47 years old and you lifted weights, but you haven't been in a gym consistently in 10 years, it might take longer. But for people that are already lifting weights, and I will say most people that lift weights are not training, they're just exercising with weights. If we shift them to training for 5 months, they will be confident and comfortable getting on a contest stage in a physique contest.
And so what do people do to actually prep for contests like this? How many days a week are they training? How do you build that out? What do they do?
Most of our, or all of our clients will never train 7 days a week. And we can talk later about many of the things that are done wrong by the majority of people that do physique contests, including coaches and trainers. But my clients will not train 7 days a week. At most, they will train 6 days a week. Initially, we'll start 3 or 4 days a week with weights, and weight training period will never exceed an hour. Workouts will never be greater than an hour in length. The average amount of time people spend doing the programs, the workouts that I provide them is going to be anywhere from 30 to about 40, 45 minutes. That's it. And we're looking at, everything I'm going to share with you today, Kelsey, is validated by the last 25 years in this sport, prepping athletes. So these aren't made up numbers. You do not, like I have a guy right now that was working out for well over an hour, 5, 6 days a week. He's been training with me for the last 6 or 7 weeks now. And initially he's like, bro, these workouts are way too short. I've been doing way more than this. I was doing, this amount of time. I'm done around 40 minutes. Well, and he was doing cardio. Well, that individual right now has lost like 35 pounds, spending less time in the gym. So this is all validated by real world results. So workouts are going to be 30, 45 minutes, 25 to 50 minutes, never more than an hour. Initially, you're going to look at 3 or 4 days a week. So 2.5 to 4 hours a week maximum when we get started. As we go through that 20 weeks, it's possible, say the start of week 17 or maybe start of week 15, where we're 4, 5, 6 weeks out from an event, we will probably graduate to 6 days a week exercise. But again, if we look at, say, an average of 40 minutes, we're talking like 4 or 5 hours a week in total. That's it.
So what do physique workouts look like now? Can people expect to squat, bench, deadlift? Is it more single muscle, isolated exercises? I feel like, you know, a lot of people have an idea in their heads too of what bodybuilding was like in the 80s. How has it evolved in terms of the actual exercises that you do and things like that?
Well, the training really, I mean, the human body has been evolving for thousands of years. So what truly worked in the 80s, truly worked in the 90s, truly worked in the 2000s, truly works in the 2020s. And you're never going to get away, like Coach Dick Zenzen always used to say, the meat and potatoes. So you're the large multi joint lifts are always going to provide the greatest opportunity. So you are going to have the squat. You are going to have an overhead press or a row, a deadlift, things of that nature. And then, yes, you will have some of the single joint exercises or movement patterns as well. So it'd be a combination. But the goal is, when we look at physique contests, the goal is to build and maintain maximum muscle mass while getting as lean as possible. Now, that being said, as it applies to the category the athlete is going to compete in, right? So if you're in bikini, we don't want you to be too lean. If you're in women's physique, you have to have enough muscle mass and you have to be lean enough. So we're going to keep an eye on the guidelines, but we are going to use the large multi-joint lifts as well as some single joint lifts as well. Now, back to that maximum muscle mass. You know, we are going to favor things where we can use maximum weight, because then we can build and maintain maximum muscle mass. What does that mean, or how does that play out from a training standpoint? Take the triceps, for example, a dumbbell tricep kickback, where a female competitor might struggle with a 30-pound dumbbell. We're probably going to favor most of the time a tricep exercise like a closed grip bench press, or maybe a V-bar or rope cable extension for the triceps, where she can train with much more weight. Or, you know, I have a client out in California that hasn't deadlifted in some time. And we had this conversation a week ago. With the barbell deadlift, you're going to be able to train with more weight than you would be on almost every other back exercise. So deadlifting 405 versus a lat pull down with all the weight on the cable column stack, which is going to be around 300 pounds, or a lat pull down with all of the 45 pound plates you can fit on the weight pins where you load the machine, which you might on some machines get to about 400, but you're going to be able to expose the muscles you're training to much more weight over time with something like the barbell deadlift than you will a seated row on a cable machine or a lat pull down, or even a barbell row or a dumbbell row.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked a lot about weightlifting. What about cardio?
So cardio is a tool for fat loss, but it's not a tool that must be used. It has its time and place, and it's something that will get used if and only if it's needed. And the reason for that is the more cardio you do, the better shape you get in and the less calories you burn.
And how does that work?
It's, you know, the human body is built to survive. So the more you expose it to the same task, the more efficient the body is going to get at executing that task. And that's what we call, you know, getting in better shape. That's why, like, if anybody that's ever gone to a gym and run on a treadmill, anybody that's run outside, the first time you did it, you might be really short of breath. It's challenging. You're sweating. You might be dizzy. You might be nauseous. You might even throw up. If you stick with it over time, pretty soon you're like, man, I've been running for an hour and I don't even feel like I've done anything and I'm not short of breath. That's because you're getting in better shape. And as you get in better shape, you burn less calories. And we actually, you know, if we put a heart rate monitor on somebody, preferably one with a chest strap worn on the xiphoid process, not the wristwatch devices. Some of them are terribly inaccurate. But if we measure heart rate, you'll see that. You know, case in point, I weightlifted this morning for about 40 minutes and I burned less than 100 calories according to my chest strap xiphoid process placed heart rate monitor. So, and that's because that workout is from a cardiovascular standpoint, a caloric expenditure standpoint, I'm in good enough shape that the workout's easy.
And so how many of your current physique or bodybuilding competitors are doing cardio right now? Or how many do you encourage to do cardio?
So everything that we do is driven by the individual's data. How do they look? How do they feel? How are their workouts going? What's the number on the scale? And then, you know, taking all of that into account. So if an individual, again, we have that date on the calendar, we found an event, 2 to 3 hour car ride away. We backed up 5 months, 20 weeks or more. And let's say we're approaching that date on the calendar. We're 4 or 5 weeks out, or maybe we're 8 weeks out. We're not lean enough. We may look at introducing some cardio as a way to increase our caloric deficit. But typically we won't look at that until we've really exhausted creating a caloric deficit by reducing total calories.
Okay. So I think that a lot of people that end up seeking out a coach like yourself or a professional to help them, they start to struggle with progression and how do they progress the human body in the right way and get the results that they're wanting. How do you progress someone? How do you help them continue to evolve over time?
Again, we're going to look at those data points. What do they weigh? My clients weigh themselves one day a week, same day a week, same time of day, same scale. It's got to be scientific. Like we are using science to drive products, not a guess, not an opinion piece, not some random change it to change it. And as such, they update their weight. So it's apples to apples, same day of the week, same time of day, same scale. They update their photos every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, they hop on a Zoom meeting or a phone call and they share what's working and what's not working. They log their food, they log their workouts. So we'll look at that and we'll look at that timetable. And if they are not making progress towards the goal, that date on the calendar, then we need to make an adjustment. And what we adjust is going to depend on the individual.
So give me an example of a time that you've had to bump someone's intensity recently, and how did you do that?
Okay, sure. So today I reprogrammed somebody's workouts. And one of the things that I did was instead of just doing a regular rep cadence or rep tempo, we're using a 4 second negative. So they're going to raise the weight. That's the positive or concentric phase. And then when they lower it, the eccentric phase, they're doing it for a 4 count. So we're increasing the time under tension and we're doing that in a way that it's going to increase the intensity. And we are doing it on an exercise, the barbell hip thruster, that we're using because their opportunity to get better and improve their physique is in their glutes. So they need bigger glutes. So new exercise, we're driving intensity by using that slower negative rep speed for a 4 count.
Okay, perfect. So last thing about programming then, I would be really curious to hear either some of the most common issues that you see and have to fix with programming, or even mistakes that people are making, either from another coach or from trying to do it themselves. What's the biggest thing that you're constantly having to correct or adjust when people come to you?
Awesome. So it's basic science and it's what we do in almost all areas of life that somehow when it comes to physique training, we forget, we neglect, we ignore. And quite simply, that which is measured can be improved. So right out of the gate, most people are just working out with weights. They are not training. They're doing some made up BS, random this week we do this, tomorrow that, and there's no record, there's no measurement. So a lot of my clients, we use a double progressive as a way to drive intensity in a way from one workout to the next, that not only are they now training with weights, but they know when they do that workout next time, they will know in black and white that they are indeed better because what we measured has improved. So that's the biggest thing. The overwhelming majority of people just go around. Like when I look at social media, I look at Instagram, I don't do TikTok, I look at Facebook, and I see the utter and complete made up BS exercises athletes are doing, competitors are doing, clients are doing with their coaches. Like my head spins when I see people squatting on a BOSU. If you're a physique competitor, back to what I said, the goal is maximum muscle mass with the appropriate leanness driven by the guidelines for the category you entered. So if I take Kelsey and I have you squat on a BOSU, the amount of weight you can train with is not limited by the weight your muscles can move. It's limited by how much weight you can hang on to and balance on the BOSU. It's limited. Like if you were a large 220-pound adult male competitor that's not new to lifting weights, there's no way under the sun that that individual who can squat and train with over 500 pounds in the barbell back squat, he's not barbell back squatting 500 plus pounds on an inverted BOSU. Instead, he's training with the weight that he can balance on the BOSU, which isn't going to build maximum muscle mass. I see this with like just randomly making things burn, making the athletes sweat, getting their heart rate up, or making them nauseous. So I'll see some ding-dong coach that will have a female bikini competitor do like six completely random exercises back to back until she can barely move. That's not training. That's just taking an athlete and wearing them out. That's not training. So true training, that which is measured can be improved. There's a measurement. There's a recording. There's data from the last time. There's a plan and a process for the next time we do that, that in black and white, we know what we need to do to be better. And when we're done, there's another measurement. And in black and white, we can see why we are indeed better.
Mm-hmm. So the next thing we're going to get into is the diet portion, which again, this could be a whole nother episode and it probably should be. So we'll try to stay, you know, surface level for now, but I'm intrigued by this because I think whenever people have heard or, you know, Jeff tells them that I used to do figure, usually the number one thing that they say is, I'd love to do that, but I could never diet like that. So I think it's this monster for people, you know, and at least they respect it, but it's a monster. Give me an idea of your philosophy surrounding dieting. And I even want to kind of get into, can you be healthy and well-rounded and also follow a diet to compete?
So diet's a monster because they make it a monster. It in physique contests or people trying to look great in a bikini for vacation, because they take a really, really extreme approach, it is a monster. And because like in our previous podcast, it comes down to sustainability. That's why these people get on stage and they look great and they look like a bag of garbage a couple months later because they took such an absurd extreme approach. Same thing with that individual who wants to look good on their vacation. They look great on vacation and then weeks later they look terrible because they took an approach that's so extreme you can't even remotely come close to maintaining and sustaining it. So that's why it's a monster. And the reality of it is it does not have to be a monster. They make it that way. And misery loves company. So once you get a group of people with that button that says I'm miserable because I'm dieting for a show, everybody wants to get that button. And then everybody wants to compare notes on who is the most miserable. It doesn't have to be that way. And by the way, a lot of the folks that feel that that's the way it is, they've been doing this for a couple years. I've been doing this almost half my life, which is about 25 years now. Doesn't have to be that way. In regards to my philosophy, it's not my philosophy. It's not my opinion. It's what works because it's science. You know, a lot of people throw it, well, science. Well, you need to go look at the science. Like you need to go read the abstracts. You need to go read the research. science isn't an opinion piece. Science is not groupthink. Science is not, we all have an agenda that's the same, therefore we all say this the same way. That's BS. So it's not my philosophy. It's what is supported by real science. And as a result, it's what I have seen work with clients for over 20 years. So it's not my philosophy. Like, it just is. It is as much as if you pick a pen up off your desk and you drop it, it's going to fall down every time at 9.81 meters per second squared, 32.2 feet per second squared, anywhere on Earth, because of gravity, because it's science. And unless we develop a new understanding and we revise science, every time I drop my pen, it goes down, not up. So it's not my philosophy. So that being said, what works? You got to do weights. Initially, 3 to 4 days a week. As we progress over 20 weeks to getting on stage, we'll add a fifth day and typically a sixth day. You'll never train 7 days a week. How much time? Probably 25 to 45 or 50 minutes with weights. Do you need cardio? Maybe. Maybe. You know, I prepped a male competitor a year ago. He did cardio the last 3.5 weeks of his prep. So 3.5 out of 20, that's it. Okay. And he did it for 20 minutes, 3 days a week, 3.5 weeks. That was all. So cardio, yes, if and only if it's needed. Food. Protein is almost always going to average around 1 gram per total pound body weight. So if you weigh 200 pounds, 200 grams. As calories go down, or as a caloric deficit increases, and we do that by eating less and moving more, and that's where cardio would be a tool for caloric deficit. But as that deficit increases, sometimes demands for protein can and will go up. So we're never really going to go much below 1 gram per pound body weight, but we can over 20 weeks see that number increase. Fat, dietary fat is almost always, depending on the size of the individual and sometimes the foods they prefer to eat, it's going to be somewhere between like 40 to 55 or 60 grams per day. The balance of the calories will come from carbohydrates. So those are...
Go ahead.
That's where we end up starting. Sometimes an individual, like I had a female, owns her own training and coaching business. Again, they end up being around 40 and many of them are coaches and trainers. She owned her own training business and she really didn't like, as an example, chicken breast. So her fat calories or percent of calories from fat, her fat grams were a little higher than they would be for another bikini competitor, simply because she preferred to eat chicken legs and chicken thighs over chicken breast. So we might move the fat grams and as a result percent of calories from fat up to accommodate the foods the individual likes. And then in all cases, the balance of calories come from carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. And so how many of your clients end up having to restrict calories, or for how long the time, or is it more about reworking it to where they actually end up eating more, but of different things, or how does that break down?
So there, you are going to create, usually there's going to be a caloric deficit created over time, and that deficit will increase. And we're going to look at, depending on the size of the individual, again, we're going to look at multiple data points, but just looking at body weight, we're going to be looking for like a half pound to a pound decline on this scale on almost a weekly basis. And if we're not seeing that, something needs to be adjusted. So again, we don't just randomly make a change at this time, or just like, hey, we're going to do this now. We're going to be using the individual's data to make that change. Now, like I have a female client. She's a coach out on the East Coast. She's lost 95 pounds. Now, not all of the 95 with me, but in the last 3 months, she's made major progress, significant weight loss. The first thing I did was eliminate the cardio she did, reduce the amount of time she was exercising. We just increased her calories, and we're probably going to see the scale go down further.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an individual thing, and it's not always a one size fits all. And And the reason for that is an individual is training hard with weights. Again, we're not talking what most of the people listening are doing, which is working out with weights. When you're training with weights, if you're building larger muscle, more muscle burns more calories. And we need to accommodate for that additional muscle mass. And then over time, more muscle, even though we're eating more food, we could still be at a caloric deficit, which means we're losing weight eating more food.
So will you give me an example of what a day looks like for, you know, the average competitor? How many meals, what's included in those? Like, give us a glimpse of that world. What does it look like?
So the number of meals per day, from the theoretical standpoint, we can argue that 4 to 6 small meals a day is ideal. And that's true until you have somebody that, as an example, works in federal corrections. And so they, let's say we have someone that works in federal corrections. They are not allowed to bring much more than what would fit in a small soap dish, clear plastic container into work every day. And let's say they work 12-hour shifts. It's impossible for them to eat 6 small meals a day. And I had 3 or 4 of those type people, members of my gym. So we programmed 3 meals a day, and their fat loss was in line with people that ate 6 meals a day. So where am I going with that? Contrary to what you've been told over the last 30 years, you do not have to eat 6 meals a day. It's not going to matter. Like, if it's inconvenient, if it doesn't complement your lifestyle, remember, if it doesn't complement your lifestyle, it's not long-term maintainable, sustainable. It's got to complement your lifestyle. It doesn't, you know, if you can't get this 6 meals, it's not going to matter. You'll be A-okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take a male mid-30s competitor, married, 3 kids, works shift work. December 17th, he was 168.5 pounds. Today is 171.4. Again, that's just one data point in conversation with that client, looking at his photos, looking at his workouts. We've actually increased his calories as of this morning by 400 calories per day. So he went from 2,900 to 3,300 calories, went from 420 grams of carbs to 490 grams of carbs, 60 grams of fat, and we bumped his protein up by 30 grams. And I suspect he's going to gain lean muscle mass. We are going to see the scale go up, but we're probably going to see him get leaner. So that's one example. Now, the cool thing is how he hits those 4 food targets is up to him. It really doesn't matter what food you eat. It's whether or not you hit, and I teach my clients to look at it as 4 targets. It's whether or not you hit those 4 targets. So here's another one. Mid-50s, female, West Coast, Northern California, so north of where you are. She is 155.2 pounds. I just increased her calories by 250 calories. We bumped her protein by 10 grams. But really most of that increase was from about 55 grams of carbohydrates.
Very cool.
And again, same deal. Whether she eats 6 meals, 4 meals, or 3 meals is up to her. What I teach is look at your calories, carbs, protein, and fat for 24 hours. If it happens in 2 meals and a snack, fantastic. If it happens with traditional breakfast, lunch, dinner, and 2 or 3 snacks, that's awesome. And then, you know, enjoy the food you like, but make it fit within those 4 targets. And then if you're like, hey, I can't get my protein without going over on my fat. And I encourage all my clients to ask all the questions they want. And then that often leads to discussion like it did with Gina, where she's like, I don't like chicken breasts. Like, I like chicken wings and chicken thighs. Well, that's why she was struggling to hit the protein target, not go over on fat, is her preferred protein foods were higher in fat. So we just made an adjustment. Life goes on.
Mm-hmm. So how long does a competitor typically need to be on a pretty solid eating program with you?
The average is 5 months. I mean, it's going to be 5 months.
So the other thing that I'm curious to hear is, you know, I feel like especially anytime that you talk about competing, you always hear about cheat days and everybody talks about their cheat days. Do you believe in cheat days? What do you encourage people to do? How does that work?
So here's the problem with having a cheat day. Like most people will pin a quote unquote cheat day to a day of the week, right? And let's say that your cheat day is Saturday. And let's say that your husband is a strength and conditioning coach for a large university, and there's a bowl game on a Thursday, and you're going to go. Wouldn't it be nice to have the normal food that would be at a bowl football games and at a stadium and not have to say, damn it, if only the game was on Saturday, my cheat day, then I could eat? That's the problem with cheat days. Additionally, you know, I'm going to take this client. He actually owns a couple gyms in the Midwest. He's been working with me for a month and a half. When he started, he was 194 pounds. And he was eating less than 2,000 calories. On day one with me, he was 194 pounds, and I increased his calories to 2,300. Now, I'm gonna fast forward. We're like 6, 7 weeks later. He is 193 pounds, and he's eating 2,700 calories. So he's now eating over 700 calories more than he was when he started with me. And he's somebody that's in the industry. This is how he makes his living. He owns a brick and mortar training gym, right? So he's eating over 700 calories a day more. I mean, that's half of a frozen pizza. So when you look at cheat days and you look at the fact that I don't tell you you must eat only this, if you're eating enough total calories, you have the flexibility to eat the foods you enjoy, and you don't need to have the proverbial cheat day. Here's another example, male, mid 50s, 168 pounds. In December, he was 168 point. So I guess I should say a month ago, he was 168.2, eating 3,600 calories. A week ago, he was 168.8. I increased his calories to 3,900. At 3,900 calories a day, and he reached out and he said, hey man, can I have pizza? I'm like, dude, you can eat whatever you want. And by the way, at 3,900 calories, you can have like an entire large cheese pizza and still have like 2,000 calories left for the day. So the cheat meals, I don't think you need to have a cheat meal or a cheat day. The problem, if we call it a day, what happens when your birthday's on Wednesday, your cheat day is Saturday? What happens when the retirement party is Tuesday night and your cheat day is Sunday? What happened when your anniversary, what happened when your kid's birthday is, right? What happens when your kids graduate? So that's the issue with calling that one day the day, because life's going to happen on the other days. And really, if we're doing things correctly, you're going to be eating more food, staying lean or getting leaner. And at some point, you're going to have enough food that you consume every day that you don't need to have a cheat day. You can eat whatever you want, and it fits.
So I think the other big thing that works in with diet is hydration. And that's another thing that, people will ask, how soon did you cut water? All of that good stuff. And it can also scare some people. So how do you manage hydration during a training cycle and then leading up to the show, the night before, the day of, how do you handle that?
For drug-free athletes that are not taking hormones, typical, we'll say steroids, right? That's what most people are going to recognize it as. If you're not taking drugs that cause water retention, you don't need to do things to get rid of the water. And by the way, if you're taking drugs that cause the water retention, you're going to take another drug to get rid of the water. For drug-free athletes that compete, we don't mess with water at all. Nothing. Nothing. Today, we do not manipulate water. It's stupid. Why? Muscle's 79% water. 79% water. Now, just because every coach says you have to do it doesn't mean it's right. That goes back to that group think, because everybody is saying it doesn't mean it's right. Yes, there can be a window in 12 to 36 hours where if you manipulate waters, the athlete looks better competing on stage. The problem is we don't know when in 12 to 36 hours that might happen. And what happens after that moment of looking better is you rebound and you hold water. How do I know this? Because I've made every mistake under the sun. I competed one Saturday, and then Tuesday morning I was 30 some pounds heavier and I couldn't get my feet in my leather dress shoes. So we don't mess with water. Muscle 79% water physique contests or muscle contests. We want the biggest muscles appropriate for the category we entered. We don't mess with water. The other thing is when you cut water, you know, what else happens? One, you can rebound and look worse. And that does happen. Two, you could end up looking flat because again, if there's no water in the muscle and muscle's 79% water, if you don't have any water, you will be flat. And when you're flat, you don't look defined. You lose that tone. You lose that sculpted. You use the shredded, whatever, right? The other thing that happens is you cramp. So in it, in, you know, competitors that do well look amazing and feel amazing, and they are dripping with self-confidence. If you're standing on the contest stage and your calves are cramping and your biceps are cramping and your hamstrings cramping, you're not going to present a great physique because you're going to look miserable. So we don't mess with water. Sorry to the bros that do.
Oh, sorry. So what about the diet the day of then? Do you do anything special the day of the show or the night before? Do you encourage people to stay in the boat and keep doing what they've been doing?
So we'll typically, the week of a contest for many competitors, will increase the amount of carbohydrates. And the reason for that is carbohydrates converted to glucose, then stored in muscle as glycogen. And this must have recently been on the internet because I heard people sharing the numbers, although their numbers were wrong a couple months ago. But 1 gram of glycogen stored in muscle attracts 3.75 grams of water. So if we increase the carbs, we increase the glucose, we increase the glycogen, we increase the water in the muscle, and the muscles fill out and look bigger. In full muscles fill our skin out, which makes us look leaner, right? So we will do some things like that. We won't do any crazy extreme stuff the week of the show with food. We'll never have clients. We'll tell clients, don't go and eat a bunch of food you haven't had in months. You know, we're going to increase carbs, but don't eat things you haven't had. We take a different approach. Your highest carb day is typically going to be the Monday before the show, not the day before the show. The day of the contest, I'll give recommendations to competitors that are clients as far as carbs, protein, and fat. Like, here's your targets. And I might suggest frequent meals that day just because we don't want to eat a big ton of food. And we also want time for the carbs to help fill the muscles out. Again, carbs to glucose to glycogen. 1 gram of glycogen attracts 3.75 grams of water. And there too is why we don't cut water, because then there's no water to be attracted like a magnet to the glycogen. But I tell competitors, I'm like, you know, that if you looked good the Saturday before the contest, contests are typically on Saturday, and you've improved that next Saturday, if you eat the same thing, you're going to look even better. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the biggest thing is don't eat a bunch of food that you haven't had in months, and don't go and overeat. So your stomach's distended back to that uncomfortable. Like, if you feel uncomfortable, it's going to show. If you go and overeat and you're sick to your stomach, it's going to show. So there's, you know, I say here's your targets for the day, or you can just eat what you normally eat on a Saturday for a Saturday contest. Just have what you normally have, and you know how you're going to feel, you know how you're going to look, because that's what you've been eating. Or if you want to have some foods that you don't normally eat, that's fine. Just don't overdo it, because you don't want to have your stomach distended or be sick to your stomach or feel bloated, feel like you do on Thanksgiving. And personally for me, back when I was competing, when the events, if I did an event that had prejudging in the morning and finals at night, in our events in the OCB, we don't do that stupid stuff. We run the event straight through. So there's no big midday gap. When I would have a big midday gap, I'd go to a local bar and grill. I'd get a half pound burger, a basket of fries, and I'd drink a few bottles of beer. And it wouldn't matter. Like, one, the judging was already done. Two, I wouldn't overeat to where I was sick. And three, I didn't look worse when I went back out on stage.
Mm-hmm. So then, same thing that we talked about with programming, what's the biggest red flag that people bring to you that have maybe been working with someone else when it comes to diet?
Oh yeah, asparagus and tilapia. I literally had at the last event I promoted groups of competitors that were at check-in waiting to be drug tested or spray tan, different parts of the country, coaches that did not each know each other. They were all being told the same thing: eat some type of white fish, preferably tilapia, and green beans or asparagus.
And why
And
is
it
that?
Their coaches probably don't know, and they certainly didn't know because I asked some of them, and I was like, "Y'all realize this? Like, you people aren't even from the same areas. Like, you don't even know each other, and you guys are on the same contest meal plan. Like, that doesn't raise an eyebrow." The reason it whitefish, so tilapia, orange roughy, whiting, cod fillets or whatever it might be, it's all protein. So 4 ounces is 100 calories, 25 grams of protein. So it's high protein with nothing else. It's low calorie. And same thing with the green beans and asparagus. And that's totally fine. If you enjoy those foods, have them. That's great. That's wonderful. But if you don't like tilapia and you don't like asparagus, or maybe you're just tired of asparagus or green beans, you can certainly have other foods. And again, back to science, and that's why, like, this isn't my philosophy. It's not my opinion. It's science. There's, a calorie is a unit of energy. Nothing more, nothing less. 100 calories from tilapia is the same as 100 calories from beef or from chicken or from turkey or from eggs or from tofu. 100 calories is 100 calories, period. Now, what makes up that 100 calories? Some of those foods will have fat. Your animal proteins will not have carbohydrates. They'll be fat and protein. Your chicken thighs are going to have more fat than the tilapia, which has zero. The amount, the volume of food you can eat from, say, chicken thighs versus tilapia, you're going to be able to eat a larger piece of fish if it's tilapia and have it be 100 calories than you would the chicken thighs. But beyond that, a calorie is a calorie, period. It's just the way it is, folks. Again, if you drop your pen, it goes to the floor. It will not go to the ceiling, no matter what Johnny Gym Rat tells you.
Yeah. So talk to me more about posing. Do you help people with that? What role does that play in someone's success? And how do you assist them in the process?
So, physique contests are physique contests. They're not posing contests. There's some folks, typically posing coaches, that will have a competitor believe that they didn't do well the last time because of their posing. It's a physique contest first and foremost. So, that's what's getting scored. Now, you need to be able to present that. So, you do need to understand what the poses are, and you shouldn't be shaking and feeling uncomfortable. Again, you need to feel like $1 million on stage. You have to have amazing stage presence. And the only way to do that is to be confident and feel good about how you look. And if you have not practiced the poses you might have to do and you show up show day, well, are you going to feel very confident? The answer is no. So what is that going to do to your stage presence? Well, it's going to compromise it. So competitors should start practicing. And again, back to read the guidelines, know what's required, know what poses are for your category, and start practicing them sometime near when you start your actual prep. And then if you get to, say, 7 to 10 days out from the contest, and you can hold each of your poses for 2 minutes and go through each of them back to back, you'll be more than ready to get on stage without shaking, without holding your breath, forgetting to breathe and struggling to breathe, without sweating profusely, without cramping, and without looking like you're not confident at all, and without compromising that stage presence.
And are you judged for other things like female competitors? There's obviously some of them that look like they could also step on stage and be in a beauty contest. Their hair, the makeup, the earrings. Are you being judged for that, or that's just part of it?
Well, if you look at the guidelines, again, back to reading the organization's guidelines, does it say your earrings can, contribute to your scoring? Probably not for any organization. Does it say your hair? Probably not. But that being said, all of these things play into you, that self-esteem, that self-confidence, that overall stage presence. So if you're going to, like, I had a competitor ask me this yesterday, what about hair extensions? Well, if having hair extensions is going to make you feel like $1 million, then it's probably something you should consider. Now, are the judges going to score your hair extensions? No. Will the judges even know that you have hair extensions? Probably not.
And so why the spray tan?
The spray tan, and the reason the competitors are tan is, you know, you're on stage and the stage lighting is intense. So if you're fair complected, that, you know, thousands of lumens of bright light is going to wash out your definition. So the darker your complexion, the more definition you're going to see.
And then what makes you so shiny? Is that sweat on
oil.
Stage? Or
no,
what
it's,
do they
it's
use?
Typically oil. And again, the oil is going to, under bright lights, it's going to allow more definition to be seen. And if you, and we'll do this with competitors, we'll do this with clients, I'll do this in webinars and seminars, I'll show side-by-side photos of competitors that did not oil enough at all, whatever, and you can't see definition. Or maybe we see this a lot on the legs, they put oil on their quads just above the knee and then they stop, and you can see the definition in the quadriceps just above the knee, but then when there's no oil, you can't see anything in the photos. So a lot of it is just so that the muscle mass and the definition is going to be visible under the bright stage lights. And
okay.
Anybody that's done any theater work or any television or video production, been on camera, like, there's the makeup and things like that that is done is needed and it's appropriate. You know, case in point, years ago, I was on NBC. And I went up to the local NBC affiliate to the studio to be on TV. And I was met with the host of the program I was going to be on, met me at the door, literally met me at the door to let me in. And she walked up and I'm like, this woman looks like a damn clown. Like her makeup, her foundation looked like pancake batter. And the makeup, like, you know, it was like Van Gogh's Starry Night or a Van Gogh oil, really thick. And I was like, oh my God, like she looks hideous. Then we shot all kinds of content. And then a week later it aired and I looked like Casper the Ghost and she looked perfect. So again, it's kind of the same thing for the physique competitors. The tan, the oil is simply because you are in that environment where it's not normal lighting. I mean, it's extremely bright. And if you don't do that, you won't see the definition that you otherwise would with the tan and the oil.
So I think a great way to wrap up today's is to go through any other big mistakes that you see people making or just missing components, maybe misinformed or not knowing in the first place, and how you've been able to help a few different types of people over the years.
Yeah. So, top mistakes that just won't die. And I'm actually doing a live event on this tomorrow, believe it or not. Cutting water. You don't need to cut water. Manipulating salt or sodium. You don't need to do that. Using a waist trainer. You don't need to do that. Sitting in a sauna. You don't need to do that. Only eating white fish and green vegetables. Don't need to do that. Lots of cardio. A lot of coaches have competitors on day one start out doing cardio 6 days a week. And then by the time the contest rolls around, some of them are doing 1.5 to 2 hours a day of cardio. Not necessary. And I can sit here for an hour and show you competitors I've prepped that have either done zero cardio or very little. Certainly not 6 hours a week. Definitely not 12 hours or more a week. So you don't need to do that. There's no truth, zero truth. This was something that was around like 15 years ago that's shown up again. The idea that you can't have sugar-free gum. Like, artificial sweetener doesn't cause you to hold water. Zero truth to that. If your coach says it does, I'd love to hop on a Zoom and have a conversation with your coach, and I'd love her to show me the data. good luck in opinion pieces on Google's not data. Now, that being said, artificial sweeteners, some of the sugar alcohols, like erythritol, I'm going to say it wrong, sorbitol, if you eat a lot of it, it'll give you gastrointestinal distress. What is that? Gas, cramping, and diarrhea. Yes, that's true, if you eat enough of it. But there's no reason to avoid sugar-free gum. There's no reason to avoid calorie-free energy drinks. I can promise you, every time I competed, I probably had 1 to 2 calorie-free energy drinks every day going right into the show. All of the protein powders, for the most part, are sweetened with some type of non-nutritive, non-caloric sweetener. Everybody's using them, yet they still get stage lean. So the idea you can't have that is complete bunk. Alcohol. You do not need alcohol the day before the show to dry out. So this is my first contest all the way back in 1999. A female bodybuilding competitor was told, and this is, everything is cyclical. This comes and goes. And at the time it was in vogue, she was told to have red wine before she went on stage. So she drank half a bottle of red wine, went out on stage. When she was walking off stage, the alcohol was being absorbed. She was hammered and she fell down a flight of stairs. Alcohol doesn't dry you out. Alcohol doesn't make your definition better. Vodka, there's a couple of fitness influencers on social media saying vodka and the gummy worms, the what are the sweet, the sour patch, like Sour Patch worms, vodka and Sour Patch worms. That doesn't improve your physique for a photo shoot or the stage. Again, if you think it does, show me the data. Again, if you've been doing this for 25 years, show me the cases of your clients that look better from having vodka and the sour gummy worm things or Sour Patch Kids, because you don't have any such data. So those are all false things. The things the most successful people do is they train with weights. They use something like the double progressive, and that's just one of them. We'll do percentage based of a 1 rep max of the 3 rep, 1 rep, 10 rep max. We'll use that with a planned progression. Again, we want to train with weights. Just like we see in a collegiate strength and conditioning program, they don't go in and randomly have back and by day. They don't go in and have a running day. Like they go in and they have a plan, and you should have a plan as well, and you should actually be training, not just working out with weights. Food-wise, think of it in terms of 4 targets and make adjustments to those targets as warranted by your progress or lack thereof. My most successful people log their food. They update their weight once a week, same scale, same time of day. They update their photos every 2 weeks. They hop on a call with me over Zoom or the telephone every 2 weeks. They ask questions and they log their workouts. The people that do that crush it. I just had another competitor win another pro card a couple months ago. It's good enough for people to be the best in their sport at the top of the industry. So those are the things that the most successful are doing. And then long-term, like we said in a previous podcast, it's how sustainable and maintainable is this indefinitely? Like, you're not going to look like you do on stage 8 weeks before you're on stage. And you're not going to look exactly like you looked on stage 8 weeks after you are on stage. The goal is to look the best you can on stage one day, unless you're doing multiple contests, but then it would be the date of the contest. If we do things right, it's like climbing a 10-story building. So the day of the contest, you climb to the 10th floor. If we've done things correctly, you should be able to stay on the equivalent of the 7th or 8th floor indefinitely. And that means that you look amazing on stage. You won't be quite as lean long-term, but you'll be awfully damn close. You'll look amazing in a bathing suit wherever you go at any time. And if we continue to work together, we're going to get your calories up to where you have enough room to have that entire large cheese pizza and have another 1,500 to 2,000 calories that day to enjoy. And the best part is when you can do that, you don't need a cheat day. Every day can be a cheat day. It's up to you and what food you enjoy.
Yeah. I think it's worth noting that One thing that I think, and we've talked about this a lot, you know, that it's so important to become an expert in something. And I do think that you are an expert in this. And something that I hope people can look forward to in working with you is that you make this safe, you make it comfortable, and everything that you do, you have an answer for why. And I think that after spending a lot of time in the industry, and even after having someone else that was a phenomenal fitness professional, she was extremely lean. She had competed before. You know, she tried to help me with my first show. And why wouldn't I believe her? You know, why wouldn't I trust what she was telling me and things like that? But to have experienced that world and then working with you, I just think that it's so cool that you found a path where, you know, you're not just going along with things that you've read about or things that somebody told you once or somebody that helped you when you were, you know, younger and still getting into things, but you've really pushed for information, data points, the science behind it, because I think that there's a lot of people that have only heard the other side of competing, and it does seem scary. It does create a lot of monsters, and you start to question if it's healthy for you and things like that. And you've done things a different way, which I think is phenomenal. But I do think it would be cool for people to hear what it looks like when they work with you. You know, how many phone calls do they get? Are you going over Zoom? Are they sending you pictures? What can they expect when they hire you?
Everything they need to be successful and bring their best to stage. So what does that mean? I explain it, and I've stolen this from many other people. It's not my statement, but you can either drink from the water fountain or the fire hose. It's up to you. So my clients get my cell phone number. They have my email address. They can two-way message me in my app. So they can call, they can text, they can email or message me in the app. There are no bad questions. Like I had a female client hire me yesterday, and we're scheduled to chat tomorrow. And I told her yesterday, I said, if you have questions before we actually hop on our next Zoom, don't save them. Call, text, email, or message. Don't wait. Don't sit on the questions. There's no bad questions. And selfishly, the more questions clients ask me, the better prepared I am to answer the next person. So that it allows me to look like I'm really knowledgeable in the space, which I am. But the way to become an expert is to learn more. And we learn more by asking more. So the more I get asked, if I don't know the answer, I'm going to go find it out. And if I don't know the answer, I'm going to find it out. And the next time I get asked, I'm going to know that answer. So I'm going to look better in their eyes, and I'm going to be better able to serve them. So they got unlimited access to me. Their virtual posing over Zoom, we'll do that as often as we need to. Every week they update their weight, like I've already stated ad nauseum. Every 2 weeks they update their pictures, front, side, and back. Every 2 weeks I like to hop on a Zoom call or a telephone call, whatever they prefer, and just, it could be a 3-minute call. Everything's going great. Thanks. Bye. Right? But I've found that having those conversations, I get a, oh yeah, I meant to ask. Or, hey, I forgot, but what about this? Monday when I was at the gym, this happened. What do you know about this? So that every 2 weeks, I'd like to have them on my calendar and we Zoom or we talk. Every week they get feedback from me. So I can see your food on one screen of my computer for 30 days. I can see your calories, carbs, protein, and fat. So they'll get feedback on that. I see their weight. I see their photos. I see their workouts. I see their progression. I see whether or not they're moving forward or if they're using the same weight and just being lazy. So every week they get that feedback. We'll chat suits. We'll chat hair removal. We'll chat tanning. We'll chat oil. We'll chat how to make sure your bikini's not going to break when you're on stage. Ironically, I had a not new to competing bikini competitor last year buy 3 bikinis from a company. And I told her, make sure they're doing this so the suit, the cups don't break apart. And the owner of the company assured her it wasn't necessary. Well, guess what? 2 of the 3 suits broke. Fortunately, they broke when she was at home working on posing and not when she was on stage, but we cover that. We cover what to do the week of the contest. We cover what to do the day of the contest. all of those things are part of what we do. And again, what do they get? Everything they need to bring their absolute best to stage. And it's their choice. You can drink from the fountain or the fire hose. I've done this for a long time. I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of people. It's rare that somebody has an issue I haven't already seen before. You know, I had two pro competitors this last year, female, approximately 50 years of age, that are somewhere within the menopause journey. So I already, and they weren't the first ones. Ironically, I just happened to have two in the same time period. Like, here's how this goes, and here's what we need to do, and here's the best case scenario to manage this. But here is why things don't seem to make sense. Hormones. How do I know the hormones? This is happening.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the goal is to kind of be what I didn't have when I started, because I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with self-taught, is there?
No, if you make enough mistakes,
mm-hmm.
and you start to learn what works. And that's, you know, tying this back, this industry is interesting. There's a lot of people that will compete once or twice, and then they're coaching, and they might coach for, well, the average, I can tell you, because I consult for the fitness world, the average is about 20 months, and then they're on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
I started a corporation to do this almost 25 years ago. So, and if I wasn't okay at doing it, I wouldn't still be in business. The other thing is, there's a lot of folks that are body beautiful. You know, we'll take the women. It is what it is. If you've forever been a size zero and you've got implants and you've competed a couple times, I'm sure you look what pop culture says is amazing in a bathing suit. Does it mean you can relate to an individual that's been slightly overweight or chubby their entire life? No. Does it mean that not only can you not relate, do you know what the tools are to take them from A to B and to take that fat weight off and build muscle mass and do it in a way that's long-term sustainable, maintainable? Probably not.
Definitely. I think that's a huge issue that we're going to continue to battle even with the influences of social media. And it's something that I've had to caution my own students against. You know, just because somebody looks a certain way doesn't mean that it's someone that you should listen to. So,
and even, you know, on the, with adult males that are on hormone replacement therapy, oftentimes if they're on hormone replacement therapy and they're a competitor, I can look at them and I can tell you if they're on drugs. The average person will see them lifting weights with their shirt off or in a tank top on social media, and they'll be like, the dude's jacked, he knows what he's doing. And I'll look at him and I'll look at what he's doing and say, that man's an idiot. And he's on hormones, whether they're doctor prescribed is irrelevant, but he looks that good because he's doing these other things, not because he really knows what he's doing. And even, you know, there's a group on social media, and they have the group has their exercise guru, and the individual has supposedly written a book and all this other stuff. Well, you can go, like, I have an author page on Amazon, like, because I've written four books. I have an author page. This individual is nowhere on Amazon, nowhere on Barnes and Noble or any of the other book sites where an author would have a page. And what, because I went, I'm like, well, this is bizarre. So I went and dug into it. He's mentioned in somebody else's book. Like, the dude's not an author. And again, like, it took me 1 second to see his image. I'm like, the guy's on steroids and probably lots of them. That's why he looks that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard,
you know, for people coming in from the outside and knowing. And again, even for me, like my story that we just went into, you know, it was a woman that I trusted, and I was young and I had an exercise science degree. Like, you would think that of all people, maybe I would have caught on to something, but I trusted that woman and I was dead wrong too. So it's very hard to know who to trust and why, and how to even ask the right questions to know if you're with the right person too.
Yeah. And by what metric, like what measuring device do you measure that potential coach or trainer that's providing information? and measure them to say, okay, they really know what they know what they're doing, and it's rooted in science and it's of sound, validated in the real world practice, or they're a complete idiot. Like that measuring stick, that measuring device does not exist for the average person or a competitor, especially ones that are newer to the physique world. It just doesn't exist. And it's further complicated by the fact, like I said, you have a lot of people doing the same thing and nobody knows why. So, well, everybody's doing it, so therefore it must be the right way because, well, everybody's doing it. Well, groupthink and group opinion's not right. That's not science. It's not data.
Well, thank you for being someone that forces the point and that relies on science and relies on data. It makes it safe, it makes it fun, it makes it far more comfortable, and I've benefited from it. I was far better off competing with you, and obviously you've had thousands of other people like me too. So thank you for today. Thank you for being good at what you do.
Well, thanks, Kelsey. I appreciate it. If you like our content, be sure to subscribe to our channel. Leave us a comment below. Also, be sure to check us out on your favorite podcast provider. See the links in the description below.